Hello, I'm Kathy Hart, Associate Director and Barbara C. and Harvey P. Hood 1918 Curator of Academic Programming at the Hood Museum of Art. Welcome to the Baker Berry Library Reserve Corridor and one of two audio tours of José Clemente Orozco's Epic of American Civilization. One of the greatest treasures of the Hood Museum of Art and Dartmouth College collection, the Epic of American Civilization, was painted at Dartmouth by Orozco between 1932 and 1934, covering the history of the Americas from the migration of the Aztecs into central Mexico to the development of our modern industrial society. The mural comprises 24 individual panels or scenes. In the 75 years since it was presented, the Epic of American Civilization has had a profound influence on countless artists and scholars, tens of thousands of students and faculty, and visitors from all parts of the globe. John Watanabe, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Dartmouth College, will host our tour. Professor Watanabe will talk about the historical context of the murals, beginning with the panel titled Hispano-America, located in the east wing of the cycle. Facing the mural's long wall and keeping the reserved desk to your left, Hispano-America is the fourth panel after the desk. Please pause your player when he indicates that it is time to move to the next panel. Enjoy the tour.
What I wanted to talk about today, and I think one of the things that oftentimes doesn't get talked about when art historians, and this is no criticism of art historians, but when art historians talk about the murals, I think there's a certain tendency to talk about the narrative and the construction and the representation and the composition of the murals. And what I want to talk about today is the historical context of what Orozco is representing. And I want to focus on the ironic nature of his title, The Epic of American Civilization. Now, looking at these murals for us, we would look at them and say, the Epic of American Civilization? This isn't how I would represent, or how we as North Americans would represent the Epic of American Civilization. And so this is a profoundly Mexican vision of the Epic of American Civilization. And I think that's something that's important to understand the images and the representations that are in the murals here, is to understand that they are, in fact, not just Latin American in general, but very Mexican. And however much Orozco was seeking to address larger universal issues of the future of humankind or the mythic nature of our roots and so forth in the Americas, the imagery that he used to represent that and to convey that was profoundly Mexican. And so what I want to do today then is to talk about those images and give you some sense of where Orozco is coming from. And again, as I said a moment ago, these aren't the images that we would use as North Americans to talk about the Epic of American Civilization. But Orozco is drawing upon images that in many ways all good Mexicans would recognize and know. So I want to try and explain that so again we can understand what Orozco was up to here. And in particular then I want to talk about two images. The image here of the Hispanic American panel here, the Mexican revolutionary, and then on the other wall on the far side there, we'll talk about the other image of Quetzalcoatl over there. So those are the two principal images that I want to talk about that hopefully will contextualize the other images in the mural. For me as a cultural anthropologist, what I think is the most important thing to remember when viewing these murals is the time that Orozco painted them, 1932 to 1934. During that time, it's the end of the Mexican Revolution, and Mexico is in the throes of trying to create a national culture following the upheavals of the revolution. And part of what Orozco is doing as a muralist is part of this larger project that comes in the aftermath of the Mexican Revolution. So I think the first thing we need to understand in viewing the murals is to understand the Mexican Revolution and what Orozco is reacting to and thinking about as he's putting up these murals. The thing that we have to remember about the Mexican Revolution is that, first of all, it was the first large-scale revolution in the 20th century. And we forget about that because, of course, when we think of early 20th century revolutions, what's the revolution we think of? The Russian Revolution of 1917. Well, the Mexican Revolution took place in 1910. It began in 1910 and lasted until 1920. It was the first great social revolution of the 20th century. We tend to forget that. And one of the reasons we forget about it is that we don't know very much about it. So in thinking about the Mexican Revolution, it's important for us to recognize that it was not just one single revolution. There were a number of different constituencies, there were a number of different revolutionary groups contending with one another that led to a prolonged and extremely bloody conflict that lasted basically 10 years, from about 1910 to 1920. During that decade, the population of Mexico fell by somewhere between 1.5 to 2 million people. And this is out of a population of about 15 million in 1910, a long and bloody and very destructive conflict. It began in 1910 as a revolt against Porfirio Díaz, who was the dictator of Mexico. He became dictator of Mexico in 1876, and he remained in office until 1910. During the time that he was the president, nominally president, but basically dictator of Mexico, Mexico underwent a profound process of modernization. The beginnings of industrialization, the development of the economy, the westernization of the society. And yet what happened during the Porfiriato, as Mexicans call it, the dictatorship of Porfirio Díaz, the political system became very closed, and only if you were one of his allies and one of his friends or one of his cronies could you ever hope to hold political office. And so, leading up to the elections of 1910, there were efforts among the rising middle class and other elites who were shut out of the political process to want to change that. And so one constituency in the Mexican Revolution were what we could refer to as the reformers, the ones who wanted to open up the political system but basically leave things pretty much the same. And this group of people was represented by Francisco Madero. He ran for president in 1910. He lost to Porfirio Díaz. He was going to be thrown in jail. He fled across the border, and from across the border in the United States, he declared the beginnings of a revolution. And you can tell just how bad things were under Porfirio Díaz because his slogan was, no re-election. Now, how revolutionary is that? But anyway, you get the idea that Porfirio Díaz's system was pretty closed. So Madero is the revolutionary who wants reform. So he's not really a revolutionary. He wants the power to be shared more equitably among the elites and the ruling class in Mexico. But in calling for revolution, Madero unleashes the pent-up frustrations and the impoverishment of rural peoples. And so in the north, Francisco Villa, Pancho Villa, mobilizes the mestizo farmers and so forth in the north. They become a revolutionary force. They want land reform. They want access to property that has been deprived them. They want to share in the prosperity that's developing as the railroads are being built and connections are being made between Mexico and the United States. And in the south, Emiliano Zapata becomes the main revolutionary leader, leading indigenous farmers, peasant farmers, who have lost their lands to the growth of the haciendas, and their land has been expropriated. They can no longer meet their livelihoods. They have become peons working for other people, and they want land, and as Emiliano Zapata's slogan went, land for those who work it. And so the reformers then unleash this unrest that boils up from the bottom, and you have, in addition then to the reformers, true revolutionaries, people who want to see fundamental change in the structure of society. So Emiliano Zapata and Pancho Villa are the two. And then finally, the third group are the old landed elites and the old power holders who don't really want to see things change that much, but recognize that one can't hold on to the old guard, the old regime is no longer there. This is the group that's led by Venustiano Carranza. So we have these different constituencies. Now, in fairly short order, in less than a year, Porfirio Díaz is gone. So by 1910, old guard has gone, but then what happens is Francisco Madero wins the election, he comes to power, and he begins to be increasingly uneasy about his more revolutionary allies, Pancho Villa, Emiliano Zapata, and others. And eventually they get disaffected with a lack of reform, and finally the general in charge of the army, Victoriano Huerta, overthrows Madero with support from the United States. Madero is assassinated. And, of course, as soon as Madero, as the legitimately elected president, is thrown out, then, of course, Pancho Villa and Emiliano Zapata raise up their forces again. And so between 1913, 1914, 1915, this is, ironically, the bloodiest phase of the revolution. And it's not the revolutionaries fighting the old guard, but it's the revolutionaries fighting among each other. And so Carranza becomes the leader of the establishment that wants to come to power. Zapata and Villa are on the outskirts, and they're fighting it out with one another. Finally, in the end, Carranza wins, and Zapata retreats back into the mountains of Morelos. Pancho Villa goes back home north, and there's an uneasy kind of peace here. But by 1919, Carranza has had Emiliano Zapata assassinated. And in 1923, Pancho Villa is killed by unknown assailants, and historians still haven't been able to figure out exactly who did it and so forth. But the suspicions all point to the Mexican government in power wanting to get rid of these revolutionaries. Carranza himself, not surprisingly, is assassinated by another political faction. And so again, we get some sense that even as the major phases and revolt of the revolution wind down, their political instability is extremely difficult to achieve. It's in this context, then, in the 1920s, that Mexico is struggling deeply in order to bring together a society that has been riven by conflicts, economic divisions, regional differences, and has been fighting with one another for over 10 years. And it's in this context then that Orozco begins to paint his murals in Mexico, wrestling with these issues of Mexican identity, how to create a nation that is riven by all of these divisions and at the same time is so close to the United States. Now there's a saying that they have in Latin America about pobre México, tan lejos de Dios y tan cerca de los Estados Unidos. Poor Mexico. So far from God, and yet so close to the United States. So again, one of the problems is, how do you pull together a society that is so diverse, that is so divided and so factionalized, and yet always worried about being dominated economically, politically, and culturally by its neighbors to the north? So it's within this context, then, that Orozco and Diego Rivera and other muralists begin to try to wrestle with this problem. One of the things then that the Mexican government tries to do is it undertakes a conscious program of creating a Mexican national identity. And there are two important components to that. One, of course, is education. If you have schools and you teach people about your history and your identity, you teach them all Spanish, you make the Indians learn Spanish and become citizens of Mexico, that's a way of forging a national identity. Another important part of that post-revolutionary program was public art. And so the muralist, creating art with images of Mexico that would portray the character of the Mexican people, important events in Mexican history, became a way of trying to unify and create a national culture, a national art style, and so forth. So the murals that you see here that Orozco is ironically painted here at Dartmouth College is part of that effort. And of course, after Orozco finishes these murals here, he returns to Mexico and continues to paint murals in different parts of Mexico. So he is experimenting very much here with these forms of representation, his style, and the iconography that we see here. In terms then of thinking about these representations, one of the central images to me is the Mexican revolutionary here in this panel of Hispano-America, as Orozco referred to it. If we look at him, well, there's been some debate. Is he Emiliano Zapata or is he Pancho Villa? Well, they both had mustaches, they both had the big Mexican sombrero, the big hat, the crossed bandoliers, and you know, of course, you see these wonderful portraits of Emiliano Zapata, who's sort of standing there, he has his hand on his sword and his chest puffed out and the bandoliers across it and his big mustache and these penetrating eyes. Same features that Francisco Villa, Pancho Villa had. Historians write about people who knew Villa and who testified to the kind of magnetic power of his eyes, and that sort of with his eyes he could sort of bore right into you and he could sort of see into your very soul, and he used that charismatic power to motivate his followers. So we see here this image of the revolutionary, and I think the debates about whether it's Pancho Villa or Emiliano Zapata are in some ways moot, because I think what Orozco is trying to represent here is this archetypical revolutionary figure of all those leaders and all those peasants who were fighting for the revolution. Obviously, he has a pretty cynical view of what the future of that revolution is, being literally stabbed in the back by the generals. Orozco, who was a political cartoonist, has all these caricatures of world leaders and so forth here looking on. Orozco's cynicism is in fact justified, because again, after a decade of revolution, much of the same group that was in power during Porfirio Diaz's reign remains in power. So after this long decade of violence and revolution, there's very little turnover. The amount of wealth in Mexico, the top 10% of the population still controlled over half the wealth in Mexico, so very little redistribution. The landowners still maintained control, particularly in the poorest regions of Mexico where the peasants had fought following Villa and Zapata for land. And so again, at the time that Orozco is doing these murals and thinking about this, the Mexican Revolution in some ways, certainly for people at the bottom, was a failure. It hadn't followed through on its promise. In thinking about these images too, oftentimes when talking about the North American scene here with the blonde teacher and the zombie-like school children, people have referred to these as a kind of contrast. You know, this is sort of how Orozco viewed North America, as this very cold and rigid conformist sort of place. But again, I think if we understand our Mexican history a little bit, we recognize that this is not an image that is only his vision of the United States of coming up here to visit. Because in fact, the presence of the United States in Mexico and the westernization of Mexican elites was something that was very real and very powerful in Mexico. Mexican elites looked to the United States as a model in many ways. And so these images here, although they may be juxtaposed as North America and Hispanic America, for Orozco, these North American images are things that are very alive and well and central to one possible future of Mexico. And here, I think, again, one of the things that he's focusing on is the kind of conformity, as well as sort of wealth and so forth. But this was a model that he wasn't quite sure, is this the way that we as Mexicans want to go? And so I think the juxtaposition of these images is perhaps much more intimate than might first appear in thinking of this as an epic of American civilization. So this is North America and this is Mexico. But I think Orozco is perhaps meditating a bit here on, is this where we as Mexicans want to go? Because this is the influence of the United States on our society. The same thing with the panel over here on gods of the modern world, sort of the academics producing stillborn knowledge and the skeletons and so forth. People talk about this image as Orozco's criticism of Mexican intellectuals and the sterility of their vision and not using their knowledge for constructive ends of society. But I think here these images represent too his kind of questioning of the importation of North American and European knowledge into places like Mexico in terms of what good is that knowledge doing us, and how in turning to these other models that are outside of Mexico and so forth, what good is it doing it? Is this any good for Mexico? And like any good artist, he's showing us we can read his images on any number of different levels. To me, one of the things that's kind of interesting to think about is that this is a vision of a man coming out of the Mexican Revolution and all of that violence and all of that upheaval, and thinking about where do we look as Mexicans for a model for our future. And so I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. What I'd like to do now is to have us get up and walk over to the other side here, because the Mexican past serves as another important source for Orozco's meditations on these ideas here. All right. One of the places in wrestling with this dilemma about what kind of a nation will Mexico be, or what is the nature of Mexican identity, clearly one source for the Mexican government, for Mexican artists, for indigenous people, for everyone in Mexico to turn to, is of course the pre-Hispanic past. The fact that Mexico was not just empty land when the Spaniards arrived in 1519, but in fact at the time of the arrival of the Spaniards, Mexico had one of the greatest civilizations in the world. At the time where Mexico City is today, the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan was probably one of the largest cities in the world at the time. It was four times larger than London. And of course, Bernal Diaz del Castillo and the other Spaniards who wrote testimonies about the conquest talked about how clean the city was and how well ordered it was in contrast to many European cities at the time. So one place then for Mexicans to look to establish their unique and particular identity and unified identity is to the pre-Hispanic past. And in this sense then, anthropology in fact became a very important element in that program of nation building. And even as the Mexican Revolution erupted around it, during the teens, the earliest Mexican anthropologists came up to the United States. They were trained at Columbia under Franz Boas, the father of American anthropology, and probably the most famous student of Boas, who returned to Mexico to head up the building of anthropology in Mexico, was a man named Manuel Gamio. Manuel Gamio, between 1917 and 1927, worked to reconstruct the huge pre-Hispanic site of Teotihuacan outside of Mexico City. It's about 30 miles northeast of Mexico City. If you've seen images of pyramids in Mexico, the massive pyramid of the sun and the pyramid of the moon, Those are probably Teotihuacan. And so again, an image that all Mexican school children have come to recognize, of course, are these two pyramids, these two step pyramids at Teotihuacan, the place of the gods, the pyramid of the sun and the pyramid of the moon. And it's between 1917 and 1927 that Manuel Gamio does both archaeological and ethnographic work in the Valley of Mexico with the idea of reconstructing pre-Hispanic Aztec and Central Mexican culture. Now, this led to the idea of what's called indigenismo. And this is an ideology that is unique to Mexico. It originates in Mexico in the 1930s, about the time that Orozco is painting. The Minister of Education, José Vasconcelos, develops this idea of indigenismo, which, not quite tongue-in-cheek, but almost, I like to refer to as a policy that glorifies dead Indians while seeking to assimilate living ones. And again, this is how the Mexican government, you know, always faced with this dilemma. If you glorify the pre-Hispanic past, and yet you have a population in a country that is close, at that time, probably 40% indigenous, didn't speak Spanish as a first language, had different customs, different religious practices, were subsistence farmers, not oriented toward the marketplace and so forth. You know, if you glorify their ancestors, then what do you do with living Indians? Because all those cultural, ethnic differences and so forth are really going to make it a lot harder for you to unify the country. And so to deal with this contradiction, then the government develops this idea of indigenismo, the idea that we're going to glorify the Indian past because that is a signal achievement that is unique to Mexico, that literally puts Mexico on the map and makes it different from any other culture anywhere else, and makes the combination then of the indigenous civilizations and Hispanic civilization a unique synthesis. And José Vasconcelos developed this idea of la raza cósmica, the cosmic race, Mexicans as this synthesis of these two distinct and yet vibrant traditions, the indigenous and the Spanish. And this is going to be what makes Mexico unique. But of course, in building a nation, the model that one has as a nation of nation building is homogenizing your population, making sure everybody speaks the same language, has the same beliefs, and has a sense of abiding nationalism and national identity. And so part and parcel, ironically, in glorifying the Indian past, they used anthropology to study quote-unquote native villages in order to not to preserve their culture, but in order to figure out how better to assimilate people into Mexican national culture, how to integrate them into markets, how to educate them in speaking Spanish, and so on and so forth. And so again, part of the muralists' project, Orozco, Diego Rivera, and others, was to create this imagery that would bring all these diverse populations together and instill in them a single unified Mexican identity. Now, one of the important figures in that confluence, if you will, or the combination of the Hispanic and the indigenous, is the figure of Quetzalcoatl, a Nahuatl name, a language spoken by the Aztecs. And Quetzalcoatl is this godlike figure in Mesoamerican Mexican mythology. It refers to both a deity, but also possibly a historical personage, a king, a god king, if you will, who rules at a time, brings agriculture to Mexico, creates sort of a peaceful society, and rather than based on human sacrifice that Orozco represents to us over here as a central part of ancient Mexican religions, Quetzalcoatl was opposed, at least according to the myth, to sacrifice, to human sacrifice. And so again, Orozco builds on this image of Quetzalcoatl as bringing the golden age, if you will, to Mexico, the building of the pyramids, the waking up of the sleeping population to one sort of exchanging ideas and in conversation. And of course here again, you know, bringing corn, the lifeblood of Mesoamerican civilizations, bringing writing, the creation of monuments and writing, literate civilization, high civilization. And yet, as the legend goes, Quetzalcoatl was too good to be true, so one of his evil brothers, incarnation of Tezcatlipoca, he's this guy over here with the striped black mask over in the panel here of the Golden Age, he's the deity behind. He overthrows Quetzalcoatl, drives him out, and as he's being driven away, he's driven to the coast, he gets on a raft of serpents and sails off across the eastern sea. And he says that he will return one day in the year one reed, one reed being one of the years in the Aztec calendar, and says that he will return then, and of course sails off across the sea and is never heard of again. Now, there's a popular legend that, of course, I'm sure all of you have read or heard about at one time or another, that one way that we can explain the fact that Hernan Cortes, when he arrives on the Gulf Coast of Mexico in 1519 with some 500 Spanish soldiers, some people might call them mercenaries, invades Mexico and within 2 years has defeated the most powerful empire in central Mexico. And how could he possibly have done that? And of course, we refer to the fact that he's got steel swords, 3 feet of good Toledo steel was always a good way to persuade people to your point of view. He had horses, he had cannon. And the thing that people don't oftentimes recognize is that, of course, he had tens of thousands of indigenous allies, too, of people who were revolting against the Aztecs, but that's another story. The other element that we like to tell ourselves in terms of explaining the European conquest of Mexico is the fact that Moctezuma, the Aztec ruler at the time, thought that Cortes was the returning Quetzalcoatl, that he'd returned from over the seas, and as a returning god, he was not to be opposed, and so, of course, he vacillated, didn't resist, and waited until too long to turn on Cortes, and therefore Cortes got the advantage. Now, interestingly enough, when we read Cortes' diaries, which are the closest thing we have to eyewitness accounts of his first meetings with Moctezuma, arrival in Tenochtitlan, the conquest of the Aztecs, and so forth, interestingly enough, there's no mention that Moctezuma thought of him as a god. The closest thing that we have is possibly that Moctezuma might have thought of him as an emissary of a king who had long departed and left and came back. So again, you know, there's a little bit of sort of playing around with this in terms of identifying Cortes as a god and sort of that the superstitious Indians kind of succumbing to the hard-headed, practical soldier politician of Cortes. But in addition to rationalizing the conquest, though, there's a deeper problem involved here in terms of how to connect up these indigenous people that people like Cortes were running into. It raised a number of problems. It raised a theological problem. For instance, how could this whole world, literally the New World, be created and be populated by all of these people and the Bible not saying anything about it? Because, of course, God created the world, and yet we didn't know any of these people were there. And so the discovery of the New World created a theological problem. How do you deal with these people? And of course, eventually the Pope had to declare that the natives of the New World, in fact, were human beings and they had souls and therefore could be saved. But the fact that that was even a question to be asked suggests how much of a shock it was to the Europeans when they first arrived in the New World. The other question that it raised was a historical one, because when the Spaniards arrived and they traveled through Mesoamerica, they saw images that struck them as very familiar. They found crosses down in the Maya area, in Yucatan and in Guatemala. They found these St. Andrew's crosses that the Maya seemed to venerate. They found practices of oral confession, where people would confess their sins to the priests. They found practices of circumcision. All of these kinds of things that they immediately read and saw and interpreted in terms of what they themselves were most familiar with, the Judeo-Christian kind of background. And they begin wondering, and then they hear about this legend of this king who sort of brings reform and so forth, and who is represented as having a beard, which of course most Indians don't have. So they begin to think, well, is it possible that there might have been some pre-Cortesian contact in the New World? And so by the 18th century, a theory has been developed that Quetzalcoatl, in fact, was the apostle St. Thomas, who had come to the New World, had evangelized the people, but of course the Indians had rejected him and he'd been driven out. And one of the reasons that Quetzalcoatl is identified with St. Thomas is that St. Thomas was said to be a twin. One of the apostles of Jesus was said to be a twin, and one of the many names for Quetzalcoatl was Precious Twin. So the friars and other people were making all of these associations, trying to find a connection between the New World and the Old that would validate the Bible as a source of knowledge and the creation story and so forth as a source of knowledge. All of this becomes increasingly important as local elites in Mexico decide increasingly that they don't want to be under the thumb of Spain and they want independence. And so during the times of independence, this myth of Quetzalcoatl as St. Thomas becomes increasingly politically important, because of course what that does is it says that the Spanish conquest of the New World was perhaps to a certain extent redundant, in the sense that if the Spaniards wanted to say one of the important reasons or outcomes of the conquest of the New World was the evangelization of native peoples, then this myth of St. Thomas coming before Cortes invalidated the claim of the Spaniards that the important thing they did was evangelize the people. Now, there's some slippage here, of course, because one could argue the Indians rejected St. Thomas and got rid of him, so, you know, maybe they needed to be evangelized the second time anyway. But for the elites in colonial Mexico who were beginning to seek independence, these different kinds of connections, again, of establishing an independent base for their claims of legitimacy within Mexico, as opposed to simply being an extension of Spain, becomes extremely important. So again, Quetzalcoatl, as this image that occupies so much space on this side of the mural, becomes a crucial image historically for Mexico. I'm not at all surprised that Orozco, in painting these murals, uses this motif of Quetzalcoatl, because he represents a struggle that goes back to the 18th century and through the 19th century, and now in post-revolutionary Mexico in the 20th century, of searching for images and ideas and interconnections that provide a unique and powerful and compelling iconography for a Mexican national identity, for a heritage that is Spanish and yet distinct from Spain because of the Indian heritage, and yet not entirely Indian either, because, of course, Orozco and others didn't want to be like those poor Indians living in the villages in the mountains, subsistence farmers. They wanted to be modern, contemporary members of the modern world as well. In that regard, then, I think that's about all of that I really have to say about the historical context of the murals and one of the many things Orozco might have been up to as he painted these. But one of the things that, as I was sitting sort of up against that wall and looking at this side of the murals, this was the beginning of April, the beginning of spring term, when I brought my class in here to look at the murals, I realized that there's an interesting kind of thing going on. If you look way over in the upper left-hand corner, you see the figures here, the indigenous figures with the headdresses and the very indigenous faces and so forth. These are Aztec warriors. The iconography of their helmets, of their accoutrements, very much Aztec. And they're sort of sitting there facing, looking out over here. So if we were thinking about Orozco's paintings and panels as purely a chronological, the migration of indigenous people, the old sacrifice, the new golden age, and then Quetzalcoatl being thrown out, what are those Aztec warriors doing right there in the corner before the Aztecs were there? Because the Aztecs weren't at Teotihuacan, they only came much later. It got me thinking. Then I look all the way over here on the opposite side, and what do we see? We see this little panel up here that's called the Prophecy, the Spanish warriors looking over here with their armor, the cross that looks as much like a battle axe as a cross, sitting there staring across at the Aztec warriors on the other side. And then I was even more struck yesterday as I was getting ready to do this lecture and reading an essay by Jackie Bass, who is one of the former directors of the Hood Museum, who's very interested in these murals, and she indicates that this, in fact, was the first panel that Orozco painted, the Prophecy, the Spanish conquistadores over here on the left-hand side. And the Aztec warriors is the second panel that he painted. And so that got me thinking that instead of a kind of narrative of one thing after another, what we have here with these two groups facing each other across all the panorama of pre-Hispanic civilization as Orozco represented it is not a narrative, but in a sense a mythic representation. This is all happening all at once. This is what stood between the Aztecs and the Spaniards. And in that sense then, for Orozco, did in fact the epic of American civilization begin not in the deepest, darkest times of migrations across the Bering Straits or whatever, but in the confrontation between the indigenous peoples of Mesoamerica and the Europeans who arrived in 1519. Thank you.
This concludes our tour of the Orozco murals. For additional information, please consult the free brochure available in the Reserve Corridor at the Hood Museum of Art, and for download at the Hood Museum of Art website, hoodmuseum.dartmouth.edu. Thank you for listening.